Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. I was a mole in the ground. I'd root that mountain down. Wish I was a mole.
First Nations and our people that been living here for thousands of years.
Stand up.
We've been fighting for our freedom since the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria.
Stand up.
Like Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Leonard Peltier.
Stand up.
Now they poisoning the waters for our sons and our daughters, so we on the frontier.
We won.
One nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline.
Good morning, friends. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 listener-supported community radio. This is Desiree Helgers, and I'm going to be your host this morning for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Today is my first time hosting the show, and this old white lady is going to dedicate it to Myron and Cheryl Littlebird out in Wyoming on the Wind River Reservation, and to all the brave native and non-native water protectors on the ground in Minnesota who are headed out that way to try to stop the catastrophe that is the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline. It's not a question of if that pipeline will leak, it's a question of when. There's an action going on today in Portland at 4 o'clock in front of the Chase Bank, which I'll be talking more about in a few minutes. On today's show, we'll be talking about the College for All Act, which would make college free for families that make less than $125,000. I'll be talking with Sarah Chivers of Portland State University and Chemeketa Community College and Marissa Chappelle of Oregon State University about the legislation, which would be a game changer for working families and for higher ed. Then Denise Morris interviews Jan Hocken, who recently published a book on politics and PTSD, and they take up the little-known history of Timothy Leary's use of psilocybin in prison settings. Then Bill Resnick talks with Patrick Mazza, former editor of the Portland Alliance and a frontline fighter in the climate action movement and author of two books on organizing to confront the climate crisis. They talk about the need to be actively organizing cities for zero carbon emissions. But first, we're going to turn our attention to the unfolding Enbridge Line 3 fight in Minnesota. A lot of activists from the Pacific Northwest, Native and non-Native, are headed out that way to help shut down construction of the pipeline. And plenty of people who can't be out there are organizing around fossil fuel divestment and raising money and collecting gear to support the actions on the ground and help with legal defense. If you want more information on the struggle and how to plug in, go to stopline3.org, where you can find a list of partner organizations like Honor the Earth, Minnesota350.org, and Greenpeace. They have an email template you can use to contact Biden and tell him to shut down Line 3. You can also go to 350PDX and XRPDX for more information about how to plug in locally. In Portland today, there'll be an action at 4 p.m. in solidarity with Indigenous water protectors in Minnesota. The action is sponsored by Extinction Rebellion PDX. The action will take place outside of the downtown Chase Bank across from Pioneer Square at 811 Southwest 6th Avenue. Activists will be holding a silent vigil outside the bank all day. People are also asked to call the Biden administration and tell them to stop Line 3. Call 888-724-8946 to connect with the White House switchboard and tell Biden to revoke the permits and stop the pipelines. Last month on Democracy Now!, organizer Jackie Fielder of the Stop the Money Pipeline observed that Line 3 would result in an additional 193 million tons of greenhouse gases every single year, and it violates indigenous rights of the Anishinaabe people and their right to free, prior, and informed consent, unquote. Democracy Now! Has also reported that Enbridge 3's pipeline would carry more than 750,000 barrels of tar sands oil a day through fragile ecosystems endangering lakes, rivers, and wild rice beds. Violence against indigenous lands and indigenous women, men, and children go hand in hand. Since the workers, who are overwhelmingly male and mostly also white, live in what have been dubbed man camps. In May, as Democracy Now! Also reported, water protectors blockaded a so-called man camp at the Enbridge site to mark missing and murdered indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit Awareness Week. Indigenous activists said, quote, "The violence committed on our lands becomes the violence committed on our people," unquote. So that said, we're going to start out today talking about the College for All Act. So my guests today are Marissa Chappelle and Sarah Chivers. Marissa Chappelle is Associate Professor of History at Oregon State University. She teaches and writes about U.S. politics, social policy, and social movements. She's the author of The War on Welfare, Family, Poverty, and Politics in Modern America from the University of Pennsylvania Press, and co-author of Welfare in the United States, A History with Documents. She's currently writing a book about ACORN, a multiracial effort by low and moderate income Americans to win political representation and economic justice in the last three decades of the 20th century. Marissa Chappell is on the executive committee of United Academics of Oregon State University and is a founding member of Scholars for a New Deal for Higher Education. Sarah Chivers is an intersectional sociologist and community organizer with Portland State University and Chemeketa Community College. She's been teaching and organizing with students and higher education workers in the Pacific Northwest for 15 years. Sarah is currently focused on building a regional rank and file movement through PCOC, the Pacific Northwest Intercampus Organizing Collective, of which I'm also a member. PCOC is organizing to resist the neoliberal takeover of higher education and transforming academia by promoting and supporting the development of a more equitable and sustainable vision of higher education as a common good. So the College for All bill was introduced in the Senate in April by Bernie Sanders and Pramila Jayapal, and the summary of the bill represented as, quote, the most substantial expansion of higher education since the Great Society of the 1960s. It would allow students and families who earn less than $125,000 a year to attend college without fear of being saddled with student loans. The bill is co-sponsored by Elizabeth Warren and Jeff Merkley, among others. And you all, like many of our listeners, are well aware that the current practice of indenturing or saddling students with loans for decades, and in many cases for life, is a relatively new practice and one that Ronald Reagan enthusiastically embraced. In a 1966 speech, Reagan referred to activists at Berkeley as beatniks, radicals, and filthy speech advocates, and recognized student debt as an effective vehicle for quelling organizing. And now we're seeing the fruits of that neoliberal assault with public universities transformed into debt delivery vehicles. So tell us about the bill. What are its strengths and what are its limitations in addressing the labor conditions of adjuncts who are incredibly exploited in the academy today? Marissa, do you want to start us off?
Sure, happy to.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's wonderful to be here, and I so appreciate your historical perspective there as a historian. Before I get into the bill, one more thing to note, right, is that at precisely the moment when students of color were gaining access to American public higher education, right, that's the era in which public funding for public education began to erode and increasing reliance on student debt. So I think that there's no accident there. The bill, I think that students have been very, very effective in raising the issue of student debt. It's become a very live political issue. It's sort of recognized as a problem, even on a bipartisan basis. And so the College for All idea, I think, has broad appeal. It's the labor, right? What we can't do is we cannot provide access and college for all on the backs of laborers, right? And that includes the army of contingent laborers we have. A generation ago or two generations ago in the 70s, 75% of faculty were tenure track full-time faculty. And that has reversed now, right? 75% of our faculty now are contingent faculty, are in precarious positions, oftentimes relying on public assistance, oftentimes involuntarily part-time, working at many different institutions, lacking benefits. So it's a very laudable goal to expand access for students. It's super important. And what College for All does is provide significant federal funding to both 2- and 4-year public institutions, as well as HBCUs, tribal and minority serving institutions. Free 4-year college for families earning less than $125,000 a year. That'd be about 80% of students. One limitation of the bill, I'd say, is means testing. I have some problems with the means testing aspect. Nonetheless, it's a significant improvement.
When you're talking about means testing, you're talking about an income threshold and the attending sort of stigma that it might carry?
Correct, right. Rather than universal access, limiting it to families making under a certain income, yes. And there's a lot of other stuff in the bill we can talk about, but I think that the labor provision sounds like what we're most interested in here. And one of the things that makes this bill, College for All, so different from the other kinds of free college plans that are at play. And a group I work with, the Scholars for a New Deal for Higher Ed, was able to work with staffers to make sure that we didn't get everything we wanted included, but we did get some attention to labor provisions. So the bill would require that institutions that receive this federal funding, essentially transform their faculty workforces and shift back to having 75% of instruction be given by tenure track faculty. And that the new faculty tenure track positions that are created by that, there's a pipeline that prioritizes current contingent faculty for those new positions. And that needs to happen, I mean, as written, in 5 years. Ideally, we would get additional things to that, right? We would get a teaching tenure track position mandate in there. We would get, for the remaining 25% of contingent faculty, decent wages, decent working conditions, requirement for benefits, all of these sorts of things.
Marissa, can I ask a quick question about that, though?
Sure. Because,
you know, I know that it brings tenured faculty to 75%. But is there an indication that the contingent faculty who are sort of brought in under that umbrella are being paid comparable wages, or are we seeing the potential for like being tenured as a lower tier worker?
That's such a good question. And, you know, I'd have to look back at the intricacies of the bill. I do know that the bill requires that institutions provide professional supports to all faculty, things like offices and professional development access and inclusion and shared governance for all faculty. I think that what this would provide is not all of the solutions in the bill, but it would provide a basis for organizing on campuses. I see your point, right? And there's been a lot of concern from organized contingent faculty about, okay, so you go to 75% tenure track, but what about the 25%, right? We're still going to have poor conditions for contingent faculty. I think that what this would provide is some leverage and a basis for organizing on the campus level to make that happen. You know, it's like the idea that the Civil Rights Act and the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission didn't fix the problem of racial discrimination and gender discrimination in employment, but what it did is provided a tool for people to organize around and wield in order to improve their situation.
Yeah, let's pivot to Sarah for a minute to hear more about the material conditions on campuses today, Sarah, because you're an amazing teacher or an amazing organizer, and you've experienced some of the horrific conditions of contingent faculty.
Thanks, Desiree. I'm sort of one of those folks that is in a unique position in that I teach at a community college and a four-year university in the Willamette Valley, and also that I've taught on both sides of the Columbia River in Washington and Oregon, and really have been able to see the power of our unions to work from a platform and build up. In my experience, I am the typical example of this two-tiered system. Many of us have the equivalent training, skills, experience, publications as our tenured peers. But no matter what we do, there's a core part of our labor that's unmeasured and unaccounted for. And our precarity in this two-tiered system is one that's really harming students, not just in terms of traditional measures that administrators use, like retention and graduation, but I'm talking about the kinds of relationship building that you can do when you have a solid contract that pays you a living wage and that you're able to make connections with students that last beyond the classroom so that you can provide them with the scaffolding and letters and resources they need to procure a job after college that will compensate them enough to pay back their student loans. So there's a lot of variability in terms of how we're paid and compensated in the state of Oregon working in public higher ed. The salary that I make at Chemeketa on a 10-week term is about half of what I'm paid at Portland State University to teach virtually the same material over the same 10-week period. The difference is that my students at Chemeketa are in much more marginalized, fragile positions. They're living on less income. And what they're trying to do is take that pathway that Oregon has dangled in front of them and make it to PSU and complete their degree. And they can't do that if 75% of their instructors are having to negotiate a new contract every term or every semester or every year. And every time we sit down to negotiate a contract, we lose more and more of our power because we're so isolated from one another. I just spent an hour on the phone this morning with an adjunct at Portland State who's been teaching virtually the same classes as me, but they're not hiring them back because of one student complaint. So the bureaucracy and administrators are able to use the two-tier system in ways that continue to erase the value and comparable worth that we have with our tenured peers. And this kind of hierarchy isn't necessarily one that we're going to be able to deconstruct with this bill. But I think I agree with Marissa that it's a start for somewhere, and that the bill would give hiring preference or priorities to candidates internally is something that none of us have right now. So just that little bit of a seed is enough to, I think, inspire those of us that are isolated from one another to connect and get to that place of next fall being ready to strike and building that power that we need at the bargaining table at a local level.
Do you want to say more about the looming strike?
At this point, I'm seeing some of the folks that are organizing with our unions talk about building a strike fund. And I'm really encouraged by that because it's taken several years of mentioning it before people are really getting on board. But I think I'm really seeing signs that our local union leadership is ready to use new tools of organizing and tools that rely less on bureaucracy and more on the tools of rank and file.
Thanks, Sarah.
That's so exciting to hear that mobilization. You know, our faculty union, which we organized just in the last few years, we're a new union, includes tenure track, tenured and contingent faculty. And what a lot of us keep trying to emphasize is that the privileges that those of us who have tenure have is really on the backs of exploited colleagues, right? We have the opportunity to have research and scholarship as a key part of our job and to have fewer classes to teach because of the labor, the exploited labor of our contingent faculty colleagues who are teaching more than twice what we have to teach and often much more than that. So I think this problem of contingency and the precarity of faculty labor has to be at the center of what we're talking about. Again, we can't offer free college for all on the backs of labor, right? What has happened over the last two generations is that there's been a political project to erode public goods and to extract profit. And that has to do with increasing the cost of college. So that's why we have families in debt for decades, indentured to serving their debt. And that's why we have this effort to contain labor costs. If you look at the labor costs on campuses, right, there's been no real wage growth for contingent faculty in the past two decades. There was a 2015 study that found that a quarter of adjunct faculty rely on public assistance. This is untenable, and we have to find ways to bring all of us together as faculty, staff, and students to transform this. Because I think one of the really key points that Sarah makes is that faculty working conditions are student learning conditions. So we all have an interest in transforming the way higher education works.
In many respects, these are our own grad students. It's like, right? I mean, as professors, we're mentoring graduate students who are coming through the system and then who are entering a university with extremely exploitive conditions that are very different from our own working conditions. And so, you know, if we're silent over that, we are really that much more exponentially complicit in their exploitation.
Yeah. I mean, training grad students at this point is such a, you want to encourage students. We need researchers. We need instructors. We need higher ed for our democracy to survive and for us to be able to confront the challenges of climate change and racial injustice and, right, all of the big problems we face. And yet it does feel almost, you know, you feel guilty about encouraging students to go into higher education because you know that they're spending years of their life and going into debt to get this training and this expertise, and then it's not going to pay off.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much for that commentary. My guests today have been Marissa Chappell from Oregon State University in the Department of History and Sarah Chivers from Portland State University and Chemeketa Community College. And we've been talking about the College for All bill. So we'll post a link with more information about the College for All bill when we post the show. And thank you so much to my guests. Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Marissa.
Thanks, Desiree.
Thanks, Desiree.
This has been Desiree Hellers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Community Supported Radio. This is Desiree Helgers. I'm your host this morning for the Old Mole Variety Hour. You were just listening to a clip of Taino Tuscarora singer-songwriter Pura Fe singing My People, My Land. And before that, we were listening to an interview on the College for All Act. I've been talking this morning about the brave activists who are already on the ground in Minnesota or are headed out that way to help stop fossil fuel companies from destroying ancient Anishinaabe rice beds and fresh waterways. If you can't make it out there, but you want to help stop the fossil fuel industry from burning the planet to the ground, think about joining or starting a fossil fuel divestment campaign at your community college or university. If you haven't read the High Country News series on land grab universities that began in March 2020, do check it out. The series on the Morrill Acts of 1862 and 1890 that established land-grant universities across the country was a bit of a shocker to some of us who are under the mistaken impression that the only land granted was the land that the universities are sited on. The Morrill Act established a host of state universities across the U.S. and also helped fund a number of private universities. And as the article makes clear, the act was responsible for alienating 250 tribal nations in the U.S. of over 11 million acres of land. And some of that land is still being held by and generating funds for universities today. And across the country, a lot of those universities are heavily invested in fossil fuels, and reservations are among the hardest hit frontline communities when it comes to the climate crisis. So again, do check out the land grab series that began in the March 2020 edition of High Country News. Next up, Denise Morris interviews Mole member, psychologist-filmmaker Jan Hocken about the little-known history of Timothy Leary's use of psilocybin in prison settings.
From the New York Times article, The Psychedelic Revolution is Coming, Psychiatry May Never Be the Same, May 2021, Andrew Jacobs writes, quote, though researchers are still trying to understand the cognitive and therapeutic mechanics of psychedelics, they have concluded that psilocybin, DMT, and other psychoactive chemicals can help people feel more tolerance, understanding, and empathy. They also induce neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to change and recognize thought patterns, enabling people with psychological disorders to find new ways to process anxiety, depression, or deeply embedded trauma. In November 2020, Oregonians voted on and passed two related measures, Measure 110, drug decriminalization and addiction treatment, and Measure 109, allowing the manufacture, delivery, and administration of psilocybin at supervised licensed facilities. It would have an imposed two-year development period. Measure 110 is the first of its kind and a potential model for the country. Jan, your book, Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD, Breaking Down, was published last year in July 2020, and it provides, quote, a new way of thinking about PTSD and a good alternative to both critics and defenders of the diagnosis. It is the section of your book, Good Drugs, Bad Drugs, that we're interested in this morning as it connects to the passage of Measure 109 and the use of psychoactive drugs for treating mental health issues. You have called PTSD the poster child for treatment, but you point out that the use of psilocybin and other related psychoactive chemicals has been tested more widely. And I want to say about you, Jan, along with being an Old Mole lifer, you are a clinical psychologist, documentary filmmaker, and professor emeritus of community and clinical psychology in the Department of Psychology at Portland State University. And your 2014 documentary film, Mind Zone, Therapists Behind the Frontlines, is a good companion piece for this subject, as the film offers, I quote, a rare glimpse of heated debates within the field of psychology over diagnosis and treatment of combat conditions and the limits of categories such as post-traumatic stress disorder in capturing the psychological impacts of warfare. So, Jan, again, in your book, you offer a critique of the field of psychiatry, and you argue that PTSD is a symptom of dilemmas in the field of psychiatry itself. You also take up a new campaign for the use of psychedelics in the treatment of PTSD. So from your perspective, is the passage of Measure 109 a step forward? And do you agree with Andrew Jacobs with this psychedelic revolution that psychiatry will never be the same?
Well, I'll start with the most immediate question, the second one, playing on Michael Pollan's book, Changing Your Mind, I think it was called, whether this psychedelic movement, therapeutic use of psychedelics, changes the minds of psychiatry as a field remains to be seen. The campaign that drove a lot of the research nationally was organized through a group called MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, and they've been steadily moving forward to convince the FDA to allow, for research purposes, the use of psychedelics in the treatment of mental health conditions. I describe PTSD as a poster condition because even though psychedelics are now used and there are therapeutic claims here in Oregon that it's helpful for depression, anxiety, addiction, and anxiety around death and dying, that PTSD was the one diagnosis that emerged that called for the responsibility of institutions, including the mental health field, to respond to socially produced suffering, suffering for which the person themselves is not directly implicated in causing. So there's a whole history of how PTSD called for something different in the field of psychiatry than other diagnoses, and was a more difficult to manage politically because PTSD from the start was a political category and calling for acknowledgement of societal responsibility and mental suffering. But I think with the passage of 109, which kind of surprised me, it passed with a strong majority support, even though the Oregon Medical Association, Oregon Psychiatric Association opposed the measure, and many of the established media, the Oregonian, opposed it. And yet it passed. And I think it expresses one of the dilemmas in psychiatry, that so many of the drugs administered by the medical profession are either ineffective for many people or have enormous side effects associated with them. It is a challenge to the field of psychiatry and medicine in that a lot of the organizing for this was not within the professions. It was, you know, even the process of approval and certification practitioners does not require that the practitioners be licensed professionals. So there's a struggle that will unfold and is unfolding already with the advisory board formed through this passage of the ballot measure that will lay out guidelines for practitioners. There'll be an interesting fight over that. I think anything we do that decriminalizes drugs, and it's interesting to note, it's important to note that a lot of the street drugs start as medically prescribed drugs. You know, the opiate epidemic, as some people are calling it, is an effect of the overprescribing of drugs. So this boundary between a good drug and bad drug, you know, the medical profession is often the adjudicator of that border, and I think some of what people are experiencing now is how many of the drugs that are destructive in communities start out, you know, on the prescription path of a doctor. So I think there is a kind of crisis psychiatry and the medical profession is facing. It's been a long time since there were any psychoactive drugs that really moved things along in terms of symptoms of people suffering mental health conditions or what are called mental illness, forms of mental illness. I think this does challenge the profession and the paradigm, but I think more interesting or important than even the struggle over professional control over the management of emotional suffering is the way in which the settings of administered treatment are also challenged, that psychedelics really have fundamental difference from other psychiatric drugs because They are administered in a setting where the setting is important to acknowledge, traditionally under the guidance of a local shaman or medicine person who's undergone training and apprenticeship, including in taking the drug. They are taken for purposes of deep self-understanding. So in many ways, it's a revival of the human potential movement of the 60s and 70s that was very critical of the use of diagnoses and was before an era where to see a therapist, you had to have a DSM diagnosis or a mental disorder attached to the insurance claim. It is a challenge to the paradigm in many ways, but the way in which critiques of commercial practices or dominant practices become reincorporated into the dominant models is also something to consider here. I mean, pharmaceutical companies are lining up to cash in on the pharmaceutical so-called revolution. There are a lot of potentials for profit-making that many people in the psychedelic field are very aware of.
I want to get back to that, but you mentioned who the folks were who did not support 110 and 109, and maybe more particularly 109, which had a lower percentage of votes than 110. 110 provides for funds for treatment, and that seems probably appealing to people versus creating more opportunities for what folks might think is drug use. But there were supporters involved in that campaign that probably will still be involved in the development process who have a completely different perspective on this and are more outside that kind of traditional psychiatric world.
Yeah. I think both of these measures clearly are related to decriminalization of drugs, and anything we can do to decriminalizing drugs is a step forward, and that must be said. I mean, possession of small amounts of drugs, and historically marijuana, are the gateway arrests into the criminal justice system. And so many young people end up incarcerated because of possession of small amounts of drugs. But I think it's important not to be too exuberant. In the same way the deinstitutionalization movement of the 60s was very enamored with the idea of tearing down institutions and liberating people from constraints, literally, who had serious forms of psychosis. And then, you know, you can have people wandering the streets without much support. So also it is part of this 109 as well. There's quite an emphasis in the description of the ballot measure that youth will not be able to use it, that you will not be able to access it recreationally, that it will only be administered by trained mental health practitioners of an unspecified background, but you have to be 21 years old or older. It also conforms to a national trend, reduces psychedelics as a priority of law enforcement. You know, Washington, D.C. decriminalized last year possession of psychedelics, so that nationally reduces a priority. The war on drugs of the 70s was really a war on the counterculture movement, the social movements, and forms of protest that became associated with these drugs during the 60s and 70s. So in 1971, when psychedelics joined, it's called Schedule One by the Federal Drug Administration. That means they're the most dangerous and most addictive, even though it had been well established that psychedelics were not addictive. They're among the least addictive drugs, but yet they ended up in this category of the most dangerous and addictive. So this historical association between psychedelics and social movements is an interesting part of this, and how that will emerge now in the context of the social movements of our era is kind of an interesting part of this. There is a lot of discussion nationally by BIPOC practitioners on the theme of decolonizing psychedelic use, organizing against forms of appropriation, and we can talk a bit about what that might mean as well in terms of what it means to appropriate. This is a fun fact. Oregon has apparently the largest fungus known in the world?
Yes, the environment in Oregon would be very conducive for mushrooms with our moisture and what's left of our old growth stands of trees and, you know, depending on the mushroom.
And they're big and small. I mean, the largest organism in the world, a 2.4 mile wide honey fungus, lives in Oregon. Can you believe it?
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's a great place for mushrooms and fungi. And, you know, Oregon has historically been a leader in decriminalizing drugs. It was the first state to decriminalize marijuana back in 1973. And like many Western states, laws can also be passed with a simple majority. There was also the history of appropriation of indigenous practices. You know, psychedelics have been used for millennia by indigenous peoples around the world and who've developed practices around their use. And a forward-looking aspect of this bill, that there's several years of discussion and coming out of the Black Lives Matter movement, addressing how access to mental health services, access to care through this availability of this service is going to benefit BIPOC communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one of my concerns as well. I think of it in terms of how could capitalism and for-profit healthcare really ruin all of this quite easily. It's not just that Big Pharma has been adversarial towards alternative medicines, but also the war on drugs, as we talked about earlier, has been tremendously profitable. That sets up a bit of a conflict between policing and what kinds of funds come in for policing versus the drive for pharmaceutical companies to capture and control these substances, make them perhaps even private property. Somehow they'll figure out how to ruin it. Folks with less access won't be able to go into a designer clinic to have their trip.
Yeah, and I think this could be a site of struggle if there's not too much evangelism attached to it. I mean, I'm always wary of campaigns that promise so much. And in many ways, to fight any kind of politics that have been marginalized or demonized in the margins, you have to really push hard and believe in what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are two therapists, Tom and Sherry Eckert, here in Portland that pushed this ballot measure. It had a lot of money behind it from the Dr. Bronner soap company. Interesting history.
Yeah.
But, you know, the American Medical Association, the Oregon Medical Association and its allies, it's a steep hill. And I think the fact that this passed and it has opened space for critiques of the medical model, you know, I've written about from a critical psychology perspective, problems with psychiatry and diagnoses for a very long time. But this opens it up in a way that it's not only anti-psychiatry or anti the medical model, but it, I think, opening up space for thinking about not just controlling bothersome symptoms, but being more open to disturbing states or disturbing exceptional states and respecting them, exceptional states of mind, thinking about altered states of consciousness as something not to penalize or medicalize, but that humans have always experimented with alternative or exceptional states of mind, but indigenous people have developed practices that have been in many places destroyed by colonialism, but still survive, that are respectful of these states and bring them into a community that kind of holds people during an exploratory state. Mm-hmm. You know, the field of psychiatry has never promoted the use of drugs for anything other than symptoms of a disorder, you know, to reduce the noise in the machine and not amplify it to hear it better.
Right, right, yes. Jan, in concluding, you talk a bit in your book about Timothy Leary and his work with psilocybin in particular, but broad personal research into psychedelics. And he was involved in using psychedelics or psilocybin in the prisons. In closing, could you say something brief about that? Because that does exemplify these questions around knowledge of use and the importance of settings.
Yeah, the ghost of Timothy Leary has haunted the psychedelic movement for a long time, especially as it tries to fight for enlightenment in the field of medicine and psychiatry. And I think he's been, to some extent, demonized as the embodiment of what people see as the excesses of the psychedelic side of the 60s and 70s and his own maniacal charisma. But an earlier phase of his work, I think, has been left behind. It's little known that influenced me actually early on teaching in the area of psychopathology, where early on in his career, before he got fired at Harvard in the early 60s, he administered psilocybin in prisons outside of Boston. And the conditions involved prisoners over time learning about the experience and then being trained as guides for other prisoners. Prisoners could set their own goals for self-development and coming to terms with their histories. And when you read the studies, the difference between those settings and what you can imagine in a prison today in this country, It's startling. I mean, he oversold his findings, but that often happens. But on the basis of that work, he developed this approach to drug effects called set and settings. And of course, anyone who uses psychedelic drugs knows that the setting is very important. And he said, if you give someone a pill and send them on their way, you're not really creating a setting that allows them to use this altered state in a way that can open new insights. So What is now a kind of common idea and has in psychedelic culture was a profound new insight at the time, and it still is not an idea that's incorporated into psychiatry, that people who are taking a drug that affects their minds can benefit from a setting that helps them learn from that experience, and it's a social setting. And then the idea of set, he was saying a lot of the effects people have of drugs, including psychedelics, have to do with the attitude of the practitioner. If you think this drug is going to be bad for a person, or you're afraid of it, or you haven't experienced it yourself, Then you are conveying something to the patient or the individual taking the drug. And he also emphasized the way in which practitioners and his own students were encouraged, of course, to take psilocybin, because you have to know something about this experience to be receptive to it and teach someone else. And a lot of the bad trips people had early on in what was called the LSD movement were the effect of not having a culture to support the use of the drug, how to develop practices around it. So I think to that extent, the psychedelic movement, if you want to call it that, is a profound challenge to psychiatry and an important one.
Right. Dan, this has been really great and timely as we move into this psychedelic revolution.
Not sure I'd call it a revolution, but yeah, we're turning on and tuning into it.
Right. Oh, good one. Yeah. Your book, again, is Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD Breaking Down, and that came out last year, July 2020, and I'll recommend that to folks. We'll post links to that in the article in New York Times. The Psychedelic Revolution is Coming, Psychiatry May Never Be the Same, by Andrew Jacobs. Thank you so much, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
We are the hallucination. We are the human beings. The callers of names cannot see us, but we can see them. We are the hallucination. Our DNA is of earth and sky. Our DNA is of past and future. We are the hallucination.
So that was a little mashup of Jefferson Airplane's White Rabbit together with John Trudell's Hallucination. And before that musical interlude, Denise Morse interviewed Jan Hocken. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Community Supported Radio. I'm Desiree Hilligers, and I'm your host this morning for the Old Mill Variety Hour. And just reminding folks that there is an action today at the Downtown Chase Bank, sponsored by Extinction Rebellion PDX, and this is what they have to say about J.P. Morgan Chase. They say it's the number one banker of tar sands oil and other climate-killing fossil fuel projects. Chase funds Enbridge with $1.8 billion for pipelines. Line 3, if completed, will destroy indigenous lands and waterways, pumping the carbon equivalent of 5 new coal-powered plants daily, threatening indigenous wild rice fields and the headwaters of the Mississippi River. Thus far, over 240 water protectors have been arrested protesting this project. And again, that's the message from Extinction Rebellion PDX. If you want to do a deeper dive into the ways in which fossil fuel companies and capitalism more broadly are threatening all of our futures, check out Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate. And just a heads up also that Rethinking Schools has developed some great curriculum around that book. So next up, Bill Resnick interviews Patrick Mazza.
Patrick Mazza, welcome again to Cable.
Hi, Bill. Good to be back.
Patrick Mazza is an independent journalist, researcher, and activist focused on his beat is climate and global sustainability. He's an old friend from here in Portland, founded and edited the late lamented Portland Alliance newspaper. He moved to Seattle, where he founded and was research director at Climate Solutions. That was through 2013. Patrick, why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch of your recent organization work and activism?
Sure.
And your several arrests.
Yeah. In 2014, I was arrested in front of an oil train at BNSF Delta Yard in Everett, Washington. And we actually were able to conduct in 2016 the first climate civil disobedience necessity defense in an American courtroom, where we argued that, yeah, sure, we committed a crime, but it was to prevent the greater harm of climate change and exploding oil trains. Unfortunately, the judge didn't let the jury consider the evidence, but it was a first. And then a couple of years back in 2019, to support the campaign to get Chase to stop being the biggest bank funder of fossil fuels, I got arrested here at Chase Westlake Branch in Seattle and spent a few hours in King County Jail. Ironic for the county that's renamed itself Martin Luther King. So functionally, I was in Martin Luther King County Jail. I didn't have time to write any letters, but I basically, in recent years, I returned to direct action. The climate movement is something really different than it was years ago when we founded Climate Solutions. The movement has moved to the streets in recent years. So a lot more young people, a lot more of an attitude of protest, naming the enemy, which is the fossil fuel industry and its allies, and direct action. And that has had a lot to do with elevating the issue to a point where, you know, even Joe Biden says it's an existential crisis. So I'm currently president of the board of 350 Seattle. We're the independent local affiliate of 350.org. We're actually noted in the 350 network as one of the most forward in direct action. 350 PDX is, of course, right up there. And I also have recently started up a Substack, theraven.substack.com, where I'm kind of reviving my old independent journalism gig. Going to be doing some stuff which is obviously climate's important, but really on the political fractures in the United States and what we're facing in the next 10 years, which is some pretty serious stuff. So that's the kind of stuff I've been up to in recent years.
So, Patrick, today on the Old Mole, we're going to be discussing a number of difficult subjects, hard issues, the balance between direct action struggles and the struggles in city councils and the public utility commissions and the legislatures and the Congress. Those struggles are also extremely important. We have to get the means to do what we know we can do. And I know that the 350.org is, in fact, getting much more involved in those struggles, which is extremely welcome. And we also have to talk about the city and the importance of the city and the roles of the city and the state and national government. First, though, the many things that have to be accomplished. And if we don't do significant things and hard things in the next 10 years, so give us a sense of what has to be done.
What the scientists are telling us is basically to have a chance of staying in, with no more global heating than 1.5 degrees centigrade, which is roughly 3 degrees Fahrenheit, we will be pushing the climate system in ways that we don't fully understand, but the hotter we get, the more likely it is to set off feedback loops. I mean, we're already seeing feedback loops. We're already seeing the Arctic ice melt and cause greater heating in the Arctic and it feeding back into the global weather system. We're already seeing wildfires in our forests. So it's just a question of bringing global climate pollution down quickly enough to tamp down the heating, frankly, to leave a world which our kids can cope with. I mean, we're going to be adapting to dramatically changed climates. We've gone too late. But it's a whole question of overstressing the adaptive capacities of civilization. In general, we need to do everything we can to reduce the use of fossil fuels, to reduce deforestation, and to reform agriculture so it builds soils rather than exhausts them.
It also has to happen on an international basis. This is Bill Resnick talking to Patrick Mazza, a journalist. Stopping Climate Change is his beat. He's president of the board of 350 Seattle. Let's start with one of the great issues that we face, which has to do with the roles of city, state, and national governments in doing all of those things. And in particular, I think it's important to talk about the coming energy system and who's going to fund it and where they're going to go, and how we're going to superintend and build the crusade for energy use reduction and energy conservation. Without the energy use reduction, we're going to be lost. We just will not be able to build out renewable clean energy fast enough if we were going to, in fact, meet all of the energy needs of the world as they're now defined.
State governments have a massive role to play in both energy and transportation. All states have public utility commissions that regulate private investor-owned utilities. They can mandate that utilities do things such as have more renewable energy, fund more conservation. They basically regulate the utilities' profits. They have a hammer on the utilities. So generally, those are appointed by the governor of the state, the members of that board. So there's a lot of focus on influencing public utility commissions. States have a massive role to play in transportation. I mean, states get some money from the federal government, but they plan transportation. So, I mean, we have this example here between the states of Washington and Oregon, where we have two governors who are supposed climate champions who are both supporting a new Columbia River crossing to replace the Interstate Bridge. And that's just going to be a massive sprawl machine for Clark County and increase greenhouse gases. So why are supposedly progressive states that are advancing climate policies doing this kind of thing? So we need a lot of citizen pressure put on state governments in areas like that. City governments are increasingly moving to create climate plans that involve all kinds of stuff, you know, from reducing food waste, which is pretty important, to improving public transit. Cities have their own building codes. Building codes have everything to do with how efficient your buildings are going to be. In fact, you know, Portland was the first city in the country to start a climate plan way back in 93, and it's had some success in reducing emissions per capita. So cities have an important role to play. And again, that's pressure on mayors, pressure on city councils. It takes people movements to put enough pressure on. We're seeing some potential progress under Biden, but with the whole mess in Congress, I don't know how much we'll see. The real focus of climate action, really since Bush got elected in 2000, has moved to states and cities. A lot of states have what are called renewable portfolio standards, which mandate that you use so much clean or renewable energy. Washington State in 2019 passed a mandate for 100% clean energy by 2045. Now, there's some leeway in that for stuff we don't like, which I think is unlikely to happen, like nuclear. But the hopeful piece is that solar and wind have tremendously come down in price to where they are the most economical, cheapest new energy source. Last year, 90% of the new power plant additions in the world were solar and wind. Should be 100%, but, you know, so we've got a lot of policy levers at the city and state level, and that's primarily where I've worked through my time in climate. We've worked to get renewable energy standards in Oregon and Washington, and also worked to create some supports for new industries to help infant industries grow. You know, there's people working transportation. because we have all the hydro dams, we wouldn't want to build them again, but we have them now. Transportation is our biggest greenhouse gas source in the Northwest. It's the cars. Basically anything that can get people out of cars and into transit or other modes. That's all important leverage points to push on. And unfortunately, there's too much business as usual thinking in agencies. They need to be pushed by people. And I think more and more they need to be pushed by people in the streets.
No question about that. But let me challenge you, Patrick. Portland has a beautiful plan. It's beautifully illustrated. It's well over 100 pages. Very detailed, beautiful pictures, thoughtful expositions, and they've done almost nothing. The per capita use has gone down because the car mileage is so much better right now.
Mm-hmm.
Really, our consumption in Portland is enormous. Compared to Washington and California, Oregon and Portland has done very, very, very little. California, for example, now has a mandate all new homes require solar. But much more than that, California has a very vigorous program of taming and reconstructing the utility sector. And in fact, now half of the customers are served by public agencies, all of whom are trying to build out in the cities and counties where they're located to build out if they had the money. Los Angeles has the money because it has the Department of Power and Water, which is a public electricity agency that can use Los Angeles' credit rating to build out wind energy. They have to spend a little money on the big grid, but nothing like the big grid that the investor-owned utilities want to build in the state and in the country. There's a vast amount of subsidies going to go to them if they win that struggle right now in Congress of who gets the money for infrastructure. Los Angeles, for example, the area now on a sunny day with moderate winds can produce in the summer more than 100% of Southern California's needs for electricity. That is the area's needs for electricity. All they need is storage, and they can, in fact, increase, even with what they have now, and they're building out more, they can go through many, many parts of the year on purely sun and wind as they are closing down gas plants and eliminating coal plants throughout the whole of California. You know Washington better than I do, but you've done a lot, and especially with regard to transit. My sense is that the city has to lead the way in somehow leveraging their power and their capacity to build out the energy systems that the investor-owned utilities will not do, and who, in fact, the entirety of the corporate apparatus wants to have business as usual. I think the cities have such an important role, especially in the next 10 years. We have enormous labor supply for doing it. We have enormous capacity, and we have enormous resources in the world and in this country. It seems to me a political question that it's going to require the kind of movement you were talking about, a movement in the streets, but also in the streets right next to the legislators and the PUCs in the hearings. Instead of hundreds of people in those hearings, thousands. And instead of thousands in the streets, hundreds of thousands. And I think people are waking up, and that's a possibility.
Yeah. No question, cities have a key role to play. Cities are also fiscally constrained. To me, it comes to a point that I've increasingly come to in recent years, which is that we don't win this on our own. We don't win this as climate alone. We win it as part of a broader progressive victory. One of those victories is more progressive taxation, wealth taxes. I mean, you know, my God, billionaire wealth has gone from $1 trillion in 2000 to $13 trillion this year. We need to recapture some of that wealth for the public good. So we need to really be aligning with broader progressive forces for racial justice, for equitable taxation, for generally an improvement in the position of working class people. So that's where money can come from. Cities need to rebuild. I mean, cities right now are the source of something like 80% of the greenhouse gases in the world. I mean, in terms of the goods coming in, the electricity coming in. So cities can be actors. And yeah, Portland has a problem in that it is captured by PacifiCorp and Portland General Electric. There have been many attempts to create a public utility district in Portland. It always falls short. Try again. That is a matter for public mobilization. I have no argument with that. I think there should be a lot of focus on state and city policies. I think there should be popular mobilizations around them. You know, in Seattle, we have forwarded with allies in the environmental justice movement, the Seattle Green New Deal, where we're talking about, you know, real changes such as getting gas out of homes, improving transit, especially improving transit in areas with affordable housing. We have connected the issue of affordable housing to climate because here in our techno metropolis, a lot of the lower income, moderate income people are getting forced out in the suburbs where they have to drive. So we've connected those issues up here, and we are working with allies in the people of color communities. We've linked up with the Defund the Cops movement because a lot of money goes to the cops right now, and our militarized police forces that really needs to go into social programs and affordable housing. You know, we need to make these broad progressive alignments that have a program that really addresses what we now call climate justice. We need to be working with people of color communities, disadvantaged communities. I think the 350s in different areas are pretty advanced in this. And yeah, no argument in needing to focus on urban issues at all. I mean, we do that here in Seattle. And that probably summarizes it.
Yes, I completely agree. It has to be a mass movement that meets the needs of the great majority of people who live here. I think they're waking up, as you pointed out. The time is short, but the urgency of the matter will become very clear as the climate scientists predict weather disasters will increase, as will the recognition by people that it's a threat to their lives and particularly their children. I think we can look forward to that movement really enlarging and doing what we can to advance that struggle. Thanks so much for talking to us today, Patrick.
You're welcome. Glad to be back on KBOO.
Take care. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
We need the whole story seen. We're hassling before water has gasoline in it. Malcolm X moment, Martin Luther King with a dream and war boning. Wounded knee plus Alcatraz doggone it. This is for the rock with prayers we stand on it.
Oh yeah, we playing on it, the earth we camp on it. In a sweat lodge singing our songs with grandfathers. Heat rocks all in the spot, we splash on them with a beatbox from my boy B. Jam on it. Said a prayer for the black snake.
So that was Bill Resnick interviewing Patrick Mazza, followed by Stand Up for Standing Rock. Again, Extinction Rebellion PDX is sponsoring a day-long vigil downtown today at Chase Bank and a 4 p.m. action to stop the money pipeline fueling the Enbridge Line 3. This is Desiree Helligers. I've been your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and a special thank you to the ever-so-patient Denise Morris, who produced today's show, which is dedicated to Myron and Cheryl Littlebird and all those brave water protectors out there working to stop Enbridge Line 3.